Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special March 18th show. We're at Edible's Good Cider event with Gay Howard from United States of Cider and Sarah Grady from Glenwood, who helped found Cider Week New York. So we're here at the beginning of the event, and it's always fun to sit down and do a radio show when everyone's running around. You know, Crits Farms from upstate, they didn't bring something for their draft kegs, and everyone's trying to figure out where their tables are. So there's a fun of these festivals, and it's significant that we're here with Gay and Sarah, because the cider movement in New York has come a long way since you guys first started kicking around Cider Week, Sarah. So that's welcome right. To the show.
Thanks to me.
So give us a little background on Cider Week. I remember many years ago, we had a meeting, and you invited
That's
people,
right.
reps and distributors.
Yeah, thanks for hosting that meeting.
It was a very special part of my life.
So that's right. Cider Week started, almost 5 years ago now, and was part of some work that I was doing here at Glenwood in the Hudson. Sorry. You okay?
Keep going, yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I'm part of an organization called Glenwood in the Hudson Valley, and our mission is to ensure that farming thrives in our region. And we, because we're a historic apple region, had seen this opportunity for hard cider to create opportunities for orchards. And I had started to work with some cider makers and some apple growers, and one of the really sort of nagging questions at that time was, you know, when is cider going to have a category in the beverage industry? At that time, there were no cider distributors. The existing beer and wine distributors had few, if any, ciders that they were selling, and you know, restaurants, bars, shops didn't have cider sections on their menus or on their shelves. That's something that was really pointed out to me, by the way, by Steve Wood of Farnham Hill Ciders. And so we talked a lot, like, how can we create a category for cider and get more interest, get more participation, and get people really familiar with the cider producers that are here, you know, in our region, in our area. And so Cider Week was this idea that kind of sprang up from a bunch of friends and colleagues.
No, it's really become such an important thing. And through that, I met Gay from United States of Cider. And how do you see Cider Week? And the development of cider in New York.
I think it's very exciting to see that now Good Cider is an event that is dedicated just to New York cider, that there's enough cider making going on in New York State that we can have an event that focuses on the cider makers in this area.
Yeah, so we're here. We're going to taste a lot of great ciders tonight. Edible Magazine organized it with you guys, right?
You know, in a sense, yeah, we were part of it, but really mainly just kind of making the connections. I mean, one of the amazing things that I feel is happening now is that this is all growing so fast, and there are all these incredible opportunities and so many people that want to be supportive and want to participate. So actually, this event came about because there's a program from New York State Ag and Markets called Taste NY, promoting New York-made food products. And they really wanted to support the growth of New York cider and the foundation of this New York Cider Association, and they wanted that message to reach the public. So we suggested a tasting event with Edible, and Edible really has taken the lead in producing this. But this group of producers that are helping to form this Cider Association helped to shape the event and get everybody involved, get everyone included.
Well, from the first Cider Weeks, some of the people I first met are sitting here with us now, Juanita and Matthew Crits, Crits Farms. You make the Harvest Moon Ciders. Love your stuff. Thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we usually just do a little introduction, try to get to know everybody, and we're going to talk deep about cider today. So, but, you know, how did you first get involved with Cider Week and cider associations and getting out of your neck of the woods and selling product in New York City?
What was it, 3 years ago?
Something like that.
The first fall tasting, it was about 3 years ago when we first did Cider Week, and I don't know how you guys contacted us, but somebody did.
I called them.
Oh, she called us.
we're very lucky that she called us.
And we were just starting, and we're, especially Juanita, we're big joiners and like to see the cooperative effort. So we jumped at the chance to get involved.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the evolution of Cider Week, you know, we talked about that meeting, Jimmy, that you remember that was at your place. That was like, we had no idea what was going to happen that first time. Cider Week, we thought, would be, you know, just a few tastings in the course of a week. And that meeting was attended by, as you recall, you know, friends and colleagues who mainly work in restaurants and shops and some other food groups in New York City. And everybody was just on board with this idea of doing more of like a real celebration of cider in the fall. And at that time, you know, I just invited, you know, who I knew was already making cider and selling cider in New York. It was a really diverse group and a small group. And over the course of the next few years, because we had so many restaurants and so many shops that were so enthusiastic about it, we developed more focus, like what is the message of Cider Week New York City, you know, and it really is to introduce New York City residents to real craft cider, and particularly New York-made ciders. And so what's been fun over the last few years is finding the cideries throughout the state of New York, you know, for me. And a few years ago, it was kind of like a lot of just, you know, word of mouth and sussing out, like, who's out there and what are they making. And now it's happening much more quickly, and there really is a natural cider community. But there was, previous to Cider Week, not a community of New York cider makers. That's what Cider Week really fostered, and that's what led to the creation of this state association.
The timing was really right for us because we had just launched our business in 2011, in the fall of 2011, and that was when the first Cider Week was, so we kind of missed it the first year, but we were hearing about it. And then by the second year, we were excited to be involved, and like Matthew said, we're kind of joiners, and we really believe in collaboration, and we are members of lots of different associations, and so the idea of participating in the establishment of a group of us all coming together for the greater good of cider, you know, sounded really appealing to us. So yeah, the timing was right, and each year it seems to be getting better and better, so it's really exciting to be part of this event. As you know, 25 of us now, I think, are here tonight or something.
I think there's more than 30 actually, at least who were you know, capable of being involved. And that's like, I don't know, I mean, 4 years ago we had a third of that. Yeah. Something like that. So it's a big, really big expansion. For me, the idea that, you know, 500 tickets at $50 or more per ticket could be sold to come taste cider is
really exciting.
Really impressive.
It's great.
That happened fast.
It's pretty amazing. Cheers to you guys. And it's great also. Cheers. Just the fact that we get to drink all these great ciders.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, going back, I think it was over 4 years ago now, my experience with cider was I'd had some good Spanish, French, and English ciders. And it hadn't, other than Farm Hill, I hadn't really tasted any other American ciders.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, just for you guys alone, Critz Farms, Harvest Moon, I've got on the list of my place, West County. This new guy, Steve Sellen, from South Hill up in Finger Lakes, he came down and delivered to me, and Red Bird from Finger Lakes. People that have never even been in New York before have sent down deliveries, and it's expanding my palate for sure. But I just love cider, and we should talk about that. I mean, Kate, we could do the whole thing today. You've got a blog just about cider.
Right. My friend and I, Kay Michaels, are big cider enthusiasts, and when we first started drinking cider 5 or 6 years ago, the selection was limited as far as U.S. ciders available in New York, and it's just really interesting to see the growth and the diversity of cider styles that are available now, and even just coming out of New York, how many different types of cider you can find, good cider.
One of the best things about, for me to come to these things, is I can drink other people's ciders too. There's some right. really good ciders out there from my other fellow cider makers. Everybody has their own style, to the trees and what, you know, what their situation is, and no, it's great. It's fantastic. I love cider too, so it's great for us to come.
Yeah,
even as producers,
it's incredibly diverse. You know what we've got here today. Like, I mean, one of the things that I love is that a lot of the people walking in the door here right now in Tribeca, setting up this event, are clearly coming straight from their farm.
Yes,
you know, and you know, we've got a lot of people who are both farming and producing cider, but then there's also like, there's some pretty like slick companies coming through the door as
like
well.
Jimmy, you know? Like Jimmy, right?
Well, then there's Jimmy.
I don't make anything.
You make radio.
Let's go way back. So the early origins of Cider Week.
Yeah.
There was some kind of exchange.
Okay,
France.
So as I was saying before, I work for an agricultural organization, and we were interested in the way in which cider could bring opportunities to orchards. At that time, it was not even clear to me that there were more than half a dozen hard cider producers in New York. So I figured out who in the Hudson Valley was making hard cider or was interested in it or growing apples potentially that could be suited to hard cider, and I put together a group to participate in an exchange program with a group of cider and Calvados producers from southeastern Normandy in France. It was something that we were invited to do collaboratively with a group of producers from that region in France, a very small corner of Normandy where they're trying to really get recognition for the style of cider that they've developed there. And we had this incredible experience hosting the French makers here, touring them through all the operations in the Hudson Valley. And actually, we had a big tasting in the barn at Glenwood that was a tasting of all the products from Le Perche, is the name of the region in Normandy. So all the cider and Calvados, as well as some food products that we had specially imported for this event. And then similarly, kind of matching that up against products from the Hudson Valley, cider, spirits, cheese, bread, all that kind of thing. And so the very talented producer of that event was a woman named Sabine Bretschdakian, who then became the Cider Week producer and is now a partner in New York City's first cider bar, with a couple of people who were really, whose imagination about cider was really turned on by that event, Ben and Jen from the Queen's Kickshaw. So there were some seeds planted there at that tasting with the French producers, even here in our New York community. But then we also took the Hudson Valley producers to France, and we got to visit all of the producers and orchards there. And it was a really tremendous learning opportunity from a technical perspective, but it was also just so inspiring. And one of the things that came out of that was that that group really coalesced and wanted to collaborate, you know, and that was, again, sort of helping to set the stage for something like Cider Week. And so it was coming from that experience that group said, we want to work together. And what we really need is to, like I said before, you know, to have visibility as an industry and as a category in the beverage industry. And so this formula for Cider Week was to get the producers organized who wanted to be available to the participating locations, and then introduce them to the buyers, you know, to the trade, the wholesale buyers from restaurants and shops and bars. And we did that by having a trade tasting, again, hosted at Jimmy's, and publishing essentially a guide to the ciders that those buyers could feature during Cider Week. And that's the formula that's continued for Cider Week. In fact, all the public events that happened during Cider Week happened in a really grassroots way. It's, you know, it's venues like you, Jimmy, planning your events, and producers like Harvest Moon making, you know, creating opportunities to appear here in New York City. And our work really, like I said, has been to connect the producers and the buyers. And that trade tasting is a big event now, annually.
I have to say, it's been very successful, connecting us, a producer from central New York, with buyers down here. It's been very good.
Yeah, thanks.
And like we do events, we were here for 2 or 3 days, and tap takeovers and things like that, stuff you would have never heard of 5 years ago,
yeah,
are going on now. So,
yeah.
And that's all Cider Week has started, that humble beginning, and now it's really grown to something.
And I think, like, the theme for me and that experience, and again tonight with this event, Good Cider, is that we have so much to learn, you know, as appreciators of cider. And all of this innovation and growth is happening really quickly, and like the world of our local ciders is expanding so quickly. But because we as Americans really lost our cider culture in the 20th century, it's this big like restart, you know, this big kind of revival. And so we have so much to learn, just as consumers and as appreciators, but even the trade, even the wine and beer professionals who come to that trade tasting are learning. And that is an educational experience for them as well.
I mean,
for you guys, Matthew and Juanita, I mean, coming into New York City, I mean, what's the reception you're getting? I mean, do you feel that there are more people that want to buy ciders in restaurants and shops?
Definitely. Oh, definitely. 100% definitely. We've seen a big difference in the 3 years we've been selling to New York now. And we've...
I think where before you had to convince certain bars and restaurants and stores that they ought to sell cider, now they're recognizing that they definitely need to sell cider, and maybe they might even allocate a tap line only to cider, or that they always have more than one cider on the menu. So the progression is, you know, a recognition from the trade that they ought to pay attention to cider because consumers want cider, and then even take it beyond that, they want to try different kinds of ciders, and they want to be able to choose what cider they want, and their palates are getting more mature. And so, as in the other craft beverage industries, you know, there's segmentation of different kinds of cider, and so it's just grown a lot just in the short time that we've been doing it. I mean, we're only going into our fifth year, I think. So
when we first started, it was a battle just to get one cider line, and I see bars now that actually have two cider taps.
And I'm in like, bottles,
and I'm like, yes, this is wonderful. And now it's you go in and try to, they have a cider tap, and you get them, they do a lot of tap rotation, and you try to get them to get your cider in some sort of rotation, and yes, two taps in one bottle.
I like cider too. Just coming down here today, we had to come all the way down to Tribeca in Manhattan, and my stomach's a little upset. And once again, having a cider in the afternoon really settles my stomach, I'll tell you that. I'll give one brief shout out to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, and we'll be back in a few minutes here on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're doing a special extra cider session with Gay Howard from United States of Cider. Hey, Gay.
Hey, Jimmy. Glad to be here.
So this is a great idea. We're at the Edible Manhattan Good Cider event, and you wanted to put together a little cider show. So who did you invite to join us?
Well, we've got lots of producers here. We have Harvest Moon Cidery, we have Descendant Cidery, and we have Sarah Grady of Glenwood with us right now.
All right. And we might be joined soon by Ben, who's opening with the first cider establishment in New York City, right?
Yeah, we're thinking about crashing the party.
All right. We're talking to Sarah first about, you know, how Cider Week got started, and you went back to the exchange with the Normandy producers, mm-hmm. and with the Hudson Valley cider guys. Let's talk more about that, because there was also a larger project. Was it called the Apple Project?
Call it the Cider Project now. I mean, basically, that's just kind of an umbrella name for all the work that Glenwood has done related to cider, which, like I said, started with this exchange, led to Cider Week, has now led to the creation of the New York Cider Association. There are some other events that we have hosted at Glenwood for producers, with a real emphasis on discussion of cider apple varieties and how to get those special apple varieties into large-scale production so that cider makers have access to what would be considered hard cider apple varieties. So these are apples that are really well-suited to hard cider production and often might not be edible. So there hasn't been a commercial market for those apples until we built up a cider industry to create demand for those apples. So actually, we met at one of those.
Yeah, I've been to the last few.
Yep.
Sorry. Yeah, I've been to the last few of those. It's been great. Yeah.
What's your name? I've been trying to get in contact with you.
Yeah, it's Jahil Maplestone.
And you're a descendant. So you actually, you're making cider in New York City?
Yeah, we're the first and only cidery.
In Queens, right?
Yeah, we're in Queens.
Excellent, cool.
Yeah, we started during Cider Week last year, had our launch over at Queens Kickshaw in Queens, and just sort of growing steadily from there.
So how is what Glenwood's doing and impacting what you're doing? I mean,
it's great.
Are you buying your apples upstate? Or?
Yeah, I mean, everything's coming from the Hudson Valley, and Glenwood was great because they contacted us early on and said, you know, we're putting together these sessions to connect cider makers with the farmers, try and promote the growing of cider fruit up there and resurrecting some old farms and that kind of thing, and also promoting the cider industry. So,
and Ben, so you were the first place that launched Descendant Cider. What was it like for you at Queens Kingshaw? I mean, you've kind of been on the forefront of cider in New York City. Tell us about what does Descendant Cider mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, Queens Kingshaw launched with Descendant Cider, and we had an amazing turnout. A packed house. It was insane. I think there was an incredible amount of excitement. You know, and people came from all over. It wasn't just from, you know, our regular base. It was, you know, people from all over the city were coming out to check it out because it was, you know, it's literally New York City's first urban cidery. I mean, that's freaking exciting.
Well overdue, I can't
believe. Well overdue. And, so it was palpable.
We have Matthew and Juanita Kritz from Kritz Farms and Harvest Moon. So, Matthew, we're, again, at Good Cider Event. It's kind of loud, and you ran over to your table. Is your cider ready to serve?
Oh, it's ready to go. I brought a couple of samples with me, too.
So this is, what is it? It's cold.
It's
good.
It's good. This is our, what we call, four-screw hard cider. We press this on a 120-year-old four-screw cider press, so we named it after that. It's an English-style cider, and we're using a touch of maple syrup that we produce on our farm to sweeten it and give it a little bit of character to it.
It's nice. It's still really dry, too.
Yeah, it's very dry. It's only 2.5% residual sugar, so it's not a real sweet cider. But
well, compared to the early days of Cider Week, I mean, just the variety of cider we're having today is unbelievable. And, Gay, earlier we were drinking a Aaron Burr cider, right?
We were drinking an Aaron Burr Golden Russell, which was delicious.
And we love that, too, so... All right. Well, cheers to everybody.
Cheers.
Trying to
keep
it stirred up. But
I'm drinking the pom-pom from Descendant here. So you're adding pomegranate and hibiscus. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, a lot of the fruit we're using is, dessert fruit and things that are meant for other purposes. And what that lacks compared to proper cider fruit is tannin. So with all my ciders, I'm trying to work out how to get that balance without having the tannin in the fruit. So pomegranate's a perfect thing to blend with that because it's packed full of tannin. So I sort of messed around with that until I found a good blend that worked with that. I think pomegranates have kind of a funny smell, so that's where the hibiscus came from. And I was kind of looking just to create kind of a sparkly rosé kind of thing. So when it all came together...
So you put it in the hibiscus because you don't like the pomegranate?
Is that what it is? just the smell, because the hibiscus is only aroma. So just kind of adds a bit to that.
And where is your place?
We're in kind of Ridgewood, Queens. Yeah, just a tiny little...
And do you bring in fruit and juice, or what do you bring in?
Yeah, we bring in... It depends. We press ourselves. We also get it pressed. It depends on the size. Work with a few different farms upstate. They'll bring it in. We do it all there in the space, ferment it, bottle it, do everything by hand. It's
amazing, man. Congratulations. And, you know, we're going... Echoing back to the start of Cider Week... Ben, you were there from the beginning with Queens Kickshaw, and now you're opening Wassail. Tell us a little bit about how Cider Week started for you and how you guys suddenly got turned on.
It's before Cider Week. It goes back to that first event at that Glenwood put on. And actually, our business partner, Sabine Rastakian, who worked with Sarah Grady producing Cider Week, goes back to that first event with the producers from La Perche coming over and the producers from the Hudson Valley, and that was one of the biggest eye-opening experiences for my wife Jen and I in deciding that we wanted to expand our cider program at the Queens Kickshaw. And so that was an organic process that kept on going over the course of several years until enough cider became available, enough quality cider, enough cider from around the world that we felt that, you know, it was really time to start figuring out how to take the cider program at Kickshaw and put it in its proper context.
But when you opened Queen's Kickshaw, you started with cider.
We always had cider on the menu. We started with about three, but you know, ever since the beginning, we saw a great interest in cider, which is why we kept on adding to the list. It grew and grew and grew, as with the availability of cider, as with the excitement over cider. And so we saw our sales go from like 5% of our overall alcohol sales being cider up to well over 30% now. And as a beer bar, that's, you know,
pretty impressive.
That's, yeah, it's, I mean, it shows what a lot of places could do in carving out a category for cider on their beverage lists. If you make it a category, people will see it as a category, and then they'll go with it. And that's what we've definitely seen and done.
One thing I love about this show, and she's gonna
and you too, Jimmy. You've done it at yes. Jimmy's 43
as
well.
I was going to
well.
Say, this
you've
is
been
becoming
hugely
a wassail preview, because everybody wants to go. I'm going Monday. This show will be aired after you've opened, but I'm going to go on Monday to one of your preview dinners. I don't know if you know that. But
I do.
I'm on the list.
I pay attention.
And Sarah, I bet you're going to be there too.
Oh, I'm there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I was going to say, actually, that I think has been really, that continues to be exciting about the growth in cider is that, like, it's not just that we are a bunch of cider geeks and that we're excited about apples. I mean, it is not only a pleasurable,
there's some of that.
There is, obviously, that's why we're here at the table together, but beyond that, for the rest of the world, you know, there's pleasure in drinking cider, but cider is so food friendly. And that is another, and speaking to that sort of like experience of discovery, particularly for the professionals, the culinary professionals here in New York City, that's where I see there's still so much, there's still so much that could happen there, you know. So as we kind of like acquaint our taste buds with cider and learn to appreciate cider in different contexts and in different occasions at different types of meals, you know, we start to like expect it and want it with certain types of food especially. And so you know, Ben and Jen do beautiful food at the Queen's Kickshaw. I can't wait to try the food at Wassail. I know
all about,
that it's going to tell a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I know that it's going to tell a story about how cider is a complement to food. And for me, that's where a lot of magic happens.
I know a lot of our listeners, from whether they're from England or Michigan or Florida, when they come to New York, they want to go to the places that are on the show. So where is Wassail?
We're located at 162 Orchard Street.
Lower East Side.
That's in the Lower East Side.
Hold the phone. Orchard Street.
Yeah.
I just want to say Orchard Street.
Did you do that on purpose?
It was meant to be.
It was meant to be, yeah.
It's a Lower East Side cider revival.
Yeah.
I love that. But you have a chef, too, right?
And we have a chef. His name is Joseph Wynn Consejo, and he's put together an incredible menu of cuisine that's going to pair really well with cider. Some things are actually cooked with cider or with apples, but mainly what we're thinking about is the way that different flavors are going to balance really well with ciders from all over the world. And I think that the scope of cider, of course, right now we're at a New York cider event, and so there's, you know, there's, but outside of this,
Ben, do you have a couple of typical dishes that you'll serve that you think go really well with cider? Can you preview your menu at all?
Not yet.
Oh, buddy.
Hold on to your horse.
You won't tell me?
Not quite. No, you got to come Monday.
Well, for the event tonight, a good cider. I mean, my chef, David, we said something real simple.
Because
it's like, you know, it's less meat-focused, maybe vegetables with meat, kind of the new trend, which is all I like to eat. Mm-hmm. So we're doing roasted Brussels sprouts with a little bit of bacon, but braised with cider. So primarily it's a bacon dish that's seasoned with bacon and cider.
Yeah.
And I think that's how I like to cook food, too.
Yeah, so. I mean, the thing with cider, it's the same thing with pairing with wine or pairing with beer. I mean, you're looking for dominant flavors that balance really well off of each other, or you're looking for, you know, nuanced, you know, like notes or subtleties within a dish that are similar. And so that's what we're really looking for, is looking for ways that we can, you know, build a lot of layered complexity on a solid sort of canvas.
And then, you know, going up to the farms, Juanita and Matt, you guys are upstate,
Central New York.
Food. What kind of food experiences do people have when they visit you, or when you're on the farm? What do you like to eat when you're drinking your cider?
Well, the region we are in, Casanova, we're really blessed. We have lamb people, beef people, cheese people, all this
great food and right there. So we
local producers,
nothing like some local lamb chops with horse screw or something. We try to eat. We eat very well. in fact, our friends that make the cheese, they use some of our cider as a cheese as a wash in their cave. On their cheeses, and they trade us cheese and lamb chops. And, you know, what a better deal can you have than that? So
he's actually smiling when he talks. that's what I love about cider. It goes well with food.
Yeah.
But how much we drink, you know, of course we drink a lot, but we always eat too. And I think that's what's going to make cider go over the top. It does go so well with so many good foods. What about for you guys at Glenwood? Have you done any food and cider educational programs or dinners or anything?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, our focus is not public education. We work mainly with food and farming professionals, but we do host farm dinners at Glenwood once a month, and every year we do at least one cider dinner. Historically, it's been in the fall when we also feature goat meat, so we've done a kind of goat meat and cider dinner, which I'd be happy to talk more about, but one point that I wanted to make was that something that we've, like, worked on a lot with Cider Week and talked about and tried to overcome is this perception that hard cider is an autumn beverage. And it's not only an autumn beverage. It goes really well with the types of foods that we tend to eat in autumn, like you said, Brussels sprouts or braises or pork, whatever. But it is really suitable, especially in spring and summer, with the kinds of, you know, occasions and picnics and barbecues and food that we have in spring and summertime. And in fact, you know, the way, everyone has a different technique, but the way that cider was made in the past was harvest the apples in the fall, let it ferment through the winter, and then it's finished in springtime. So actually, you know, your new ciders are in spring, in early summer, and that's sort of a different consciousness about hard cider, I think, that we're
I think that's what, like, people are starting to realize that, and also that cider isn't just cider. Cider is so many different types of cider. Like, in the same way that beer isn't just beer, you have beers that go great in winter and, you know, like in front of a fire, or like a lighter one that's great on a hot summer day. And the same thing with cider, you have so many different types that will suit certain times of year and certain situations.
So we agreed the winter as well, because as much as summer, spring and summer is great and everybody thinks cider is fall, but think of those comfort foods and that chili and the crockpot stuff and the stews and soups that you make all winter. Well, a nice dry cider is a really nice complement to those kinds of meals as well. So year-round beverage for sure.
Hey, well, what's this next cider we're drinking?
So we're drinking Succession. So this is the one we launched with originally. It's my sort of idea with this was sort of a session style cider, I guess, hence the name. And
Does that mean you drink a lot of it at once?
It's just, a lower alcohol.
Took me a while to drink it. Very sessionable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure, keep drinking it.
May introduce the idea of a lunch cider.
Nice. I love it. It's really tasty. It's way too light for the madman.
So you said you have cider for breakfast.
Occasionally. Yes.
But do you have a question for anybody? Because you're like one of my favorite cider people.
Well, I'm fascinated by all the conversation here. I'd like to hear a little bit more about where Descendant is sourcing their apples and how you're selecting the fruit you use, since obviously it's an urban cider and you're not growing them right now in Queens.
I've been making cider myself for quite a few years, developing sort of different blends, like what sort of types of apples work with what I'm trying to do. And then once I kind of got to the point of wanting to launch a company, it was a matter of, you know, finding those in quantity. And that's sort of been happening just sort of organically as the business grows. So I started with some farms around Newport, and then as we needed bigger quantities, we were sort of finding other farms. And then we've got the whole problem of shipping everything in and out. So some places got what we want, but it's really hard to get in there. So it's multi sort of faceted how we have to make that decision. But yeah, a lot of it comes from my sort of home cider making days of just developing blends and working with certain apples.
Are you planning at any point to grow your own?
I mean, I have about 20 trees in my backyard.
20?
But we are thinking about getting a small plot and starting, just so we have a bit more choice on specific stuff that is not easily accessible to buy.
All right. Hey guys, hold on for a second. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes at our special Extra Cider Sessions on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special extra cider session with Gay Howard of the United States of Cider. Gay, thanks for helping put the show together. We're at Edible Manhattan's inaugural Good Cider event, and we're talking with Sarah Grady at Glenwood and celebrating just how far cider in New York has come since the first Cider Week. So cheers, Sarah.
Cheers,
thanks
Jimmy.
For coming out. And everybody's favorite cider maker who hardly makes any cider is with us, Andy Brennan of Aaron Burr Cider. So Andy, thanks for coming on, man.
Right, thank you.
I only get to see you at cider events, which is, that's okay. It's kind of what I expect.
You're always welcome, Jimmy.
But anyways, it's been a great ride from the start of Cider Week to now. So we already had the Golden Russet.
We had the
ciders,
Golden
right?
Russet. But an aged Golden Russet.
And what's funny is when we taste out of state people on New York ciders, like we did a show that'll air soon with Randall Graham of Bonnie Doon Winery in California, who's making cider now too. We always taste people on your Aaron Burr ciders because we're trying to let them see what people in New York State are making, and also because you're working with some heritage apple trees, right? That's a big part of what you do.
That's part of what I do, but the idea is not to make varietal ciders, but to make ciders that are specific to locations. So being where we are is particularly important.
Yeah, I know we're due to have a full show with you, man, because we really have to talk about stuff. But in the context of that, looking at what New York's done with Cider Week, is that honestly, when we talked to guys on the West Coast, they didn't even have cider trees, which is kind of amazing. I mean, so what do you think?
Well, in the Northeast, we have, almost 400 years of apple cultivation. Some have escaped into the wild, some have assimilated. There's places in Maine where there's, and in the Catskills, where there's actual groves of apple trees that just because of our age, we have what no other place in the country has in terms of just generations of trees self-propagating. And
I mean, Sarah, how do you guys deal with that? Because like I said, like other parts of the country don't even have old cider trees. Guys like Steve Wood are selling cuttings and juice to other people. A guy I know, Bill Lyons, he's a big tech guy. He is planting 40,000 cider trees in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, how do you see like New York and that whole thing?
I think I think there's a role for commercial apple growers who won't be cider makers to become the growers and the providers of cider fruit to cider companies. And those growers haven't been, frankly, convinced that it's worth their investment to plant cider fruit until very recently. That is just starting to change. And the reason that it's changing is not only because there are more cider companies that want to buy that fruit, but because there is a market and there's a thirst for cider. So I often try to connect the dots back like that to say that, like, you as a cider drinker here in New York City, you are showing that these cider companies represent a market for a certain type of apple that needs to be planted. And it works backwards up the chain like that, to convince those growers that it's worth planting those trees and crafting on that fruit.
Well, it's a serious commitment for the growers, too. It's not like planting a crop that you can get rid of in a year if it doesn't work.
We're talking about trees that last decades, if not longer. Talking about trees that take years to even bear fruit. And that is a huge investment for a grower.
Up until recently, a lot of them too were sort of worried it might have been a fad. It was starting to come up. No worry, they would just fizzle out, and they'd go and put these trees in, and then they were useless. But I think now, because of the work you guys are doing, it's becoming a real thing. They can actually see a future in it.
I've seen a huge change in the last 4 years in the types of conversations that I'm having with what you might call quote unquote conventional apple growers or commercial apple producers. 4 years ago, this idea of growing cider fruit or producing hard cider was so fringe, so eccentric in their minds. And now it is much less so. It's maybe not their first step. It's not something they're going to bank on as their major source of revenue, but it's something that they're thinking about and to me, you know, that's exciting not only because it means that we're diversifying the types of apple that we're growing, we're, you know, improving the qualities of the hard ciders that we're making, but we're also helping those orchards to ensure a different source of revenue, and that helps to, you know, that helps to make sure that they're viable, that they'll stay, those trees will stay in the ground.
Are you starting to see cider makers have very specific relationship and commitments with orchardists?
I think
where
that will
those are developing?
Yes, that is happening. And I think it will happen more. I think there's a lot of potential for that. But this is the nascent part of it now, you know.
The growth has been so explosive in such a short period of time that it's pretty amazing what's already happening in 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think for those of us that are, again, you know, appreciators and drinkers of cider, I think we're going to see the character of those ciders changing a lot in, like, you know, several years, because the qualities of those apples that are just getting planted aren't going to show up in finished ciders for that long.
Andy Brennan. The guy who shows up with what a real cider apple is, but you come in and do demos with these little hard cider apples, and you cut them in half. You know, what does this mean to you? I mean, you know, were you doing this before Cider Week? How long have you been doing this?
Professionally, not very long. It's 2011. We got our license, so it's... We started our first plantings in 2007, maybe, and our first like cider varieties like 2008. So not long. Our first cider was 2007. It was a year like 2013 where there was just apples everywhere. So we went around and got all the apples we could off the road and just, you know, wherever they were falling.
And what's invisible. This? We're drinking your hemlock apple.
Yeah, this... Okay, so this is a cider which has been in a barrel for about 2 years. And it's bottled just for this occasion, for the opening of Wassail. Because we actually don't have any cider right now. But this is... so it's... these are forged apples. That's why it's in our small bottle. And then in December or January, it was right after you guys came. When was that? In January?
Yeah, with our managers and cider director.
Oh yeah,
and
no, we had already put the hemlock in the barrels then. It was two barrels, so it was like right around then. It was like around Christmas. We put hemlock needles, which are not hemlock the poison, hemlock the evergreen tree. It's like a spruce tree. Anyway, you just break the needle and a little bit of like the that acid comes out. Yeah. And it's basically just dry hopping. You stick the needles on top of the cider and it gives it that sort of Christmas flavor that you have.
It's pretty. What do you think, man? I mean, you can...
I love it. I mean, it's the nuance. You get that light sort of, you know, spruce kind of quality coming through. It's just faint enough that and incorporated into the liquid that it, you know, it's not like flavored, it's just a nuance, it's delicate.
It's supposed to be our like Christmas drink, but it's a, we got to it a little late.
That's really right.
Yeah,
it's cool. But Sarah, I mean, Andy Brennan's been for us the poster boy of cider in New York, just because you feel like everything he's doing is pure and everyone loves his cider. I mean, what does Aaron Burr mean to you? Are there other cider makers that you say, you know, Dan Wilson, Sly Bro, there's some guys you can say, these are my poster boys, this is what you should be doing in cider. I mean, I'm putting you on the spot. But.
I mean, I can't say should. I can't say that. But I will say that, you know, I have been motivated personally, but also through my work, by this notion that cider contributes to agriculture. And, you know, in the way that Andy is growing trees and growing fruit and making cider, it's part of a cycle of nature. Andy's also an artist. But I feel like that's sort of where there is some romance there. You know, there is some romance there. But actually, you know, for me, it's much more about getting down to brass tacks, you know, frankly, and looking at what will ensure that we have, you know, trees in the ground and viable farms and beautiful landscapes and, you know, healthy environment and a culture of food and drink that reflects all those things.
So earlier we were talking about, who are some of the cider makers, cider growers, who were in the beginning with you, whether it be the Cider Association or Cider Week? You mentioned a few of them, Bill from Bellwether.
So the most influential cider producer and fruit grower that I have known is not from New York. He is from New Hampshire, and that is Steve Wood from Farmhouse Ciders. And he has been a teacher to me and to many of us here, and, you know, continues to kind of be a real source of inspiration and of quality and insight. In New York, you know, Steve's been doing this for a couple of decades, longer, more. In New York, I mean, I would say certainly Andy here at the table has been a tremendous contributor. Steve Sillen, who just sat down. from South Hill Cidery up in the Finger Lakes region, has been a really important contributor recently to the formation of the Cider Association. Dan Wilson from Slyboro Cider House, Elizabeth Ryan from Hudson Valley Farmhouse, Autumn Stoshek from Eve Cidery, Bill Barton from Bellwether, Scott Donovan from Blackbird Cidery up near Rochester, growing organic fruit actually.
Great. There's a lot of great people here today. And Steve, too. Steve, he came down to New York City, Jimmy's number 43. And we still have your cider on, man. Thank
awesome.
You.
Yeah, it's a great
yeah.
spot.
You also make a Pommeau, though. Like, for me, the early days was some of the French, I don't know, products, like a Pommeau, which is what? It's an apple brandy with some cider.
Blended.
You're making that, and I think that's a great product. How did you end up making Pommeau?
Well, I was introduced to it by Peter Hoover, who I tell everybody when I'm talking about how I got into cider. Who he spent a lot of time traveling. Right now he's probably around 70, in his 70s, and he planted a cider orchard about 20 years ago, just outside of Ithaca in Shermansburg. And he introduced me to cider and also to Pommeau. And the first time I had his Pommeau, that's what really wanted to make me get involved with apple spirits. And so I started making Pommeau from being introduced by him. And actually last year, he actually made a single varietal Kingston Black Pommeau, which was the first time I ever had that, and it's awesome. You know, he makes things just, he's very small scale. He's a home cider maker, but he has a cider orchard that he planted 20 years ago, so he can do great stuff.
Okay, so does that, a single varietal Kingston Black Pommeau, does that mean that he is making a cider from only Kingston Black and then distilling that into an apple brandy
that's
that is then
question.
Blended with single varietals?
Right, no, this was Kingston Black juice. So,
blended with an apple brandy. Maybe.
Sarah's putting it on the spot.
No, I just want to understand what that means.
Well, yeah, so it's definitely all Kingston Black juice. And since this is going to be broadcast to the public, I don't know where he gets the spirit.
That's okay.
But
it's, okay.
It's top quality stuff, and it's I vouch for every
so
bit of it.
Pommeau is a young apple brandy.
Somewhere. He gets it legally somewhere.
Yeah.
A Pommeau is a young apple brandy blended with fresh cider.
Yep.
And then aged together.
Right, and when you increase the alcohol content to that level, it causes the pectins and other solids to coagulate and just fall to the bottom, and so it falls bright and it doesn't ferment. So you increase the alcohol to a certain level where no fermentation occurs, but the pectins and solids just naturally fall to the bottom, and what you're left with is just sitting on top is this golden amber liquid, which is the Pommeau.
I love it. This was like 16-17%. It's kind of like a port, but it's a different flavor.
Right, yeah, it's almost like an apple port, but you don't ferment the juice first because the sugar isn't so high. Grape juice is so high in sugar, you have to kind of reduce the sugar a little bit with fermentation before you blend it.
I love it. It's a great style. Years ago, I was at Blind Tiger. They had a French Pommeau, and they poured it into a cask, which helped it aerate and picked up a little of the oak, and it was one of my favorite drinks and still is. Ben, are you going to serve any Pommeaus at Wassail?
We have a few Pommeaus.
Do you? Which ones?
Yes. We have Domaine de Pommeau, of course. We've got Manoir d'Apreval's Pommeau. We're going to have the 1066 from Orchard Hill. 1066 was the year of the Norman invasion. And they didn't want to take the name Pommeau because it actually is a protected designation in France. But you're allowed to use it in the U.S., you know, unlike Champagne. But anyhow, the 1066 will be on our menu. Are we going to have South Hill? Yeah, we have South Hill. We're going to have South Hill Pommeau. And we're also going to have ice cider as well. Right. And we're really excited to share these with people. It's not just like one pomo and one ice cider. We're having a whole lot of them for people to choose from and discover and see.
You know,
well,
just last month,
with dessert.
Talking about ice ciders and other, just last month, a real kind of beer and cider enthusiast from Belgium came into my place, and he was like, I'm looking for ice ciders by the glass. And I had to say, I honestly didn't. I said, I have the Eden ice cider in the bottle, but mm-hmm. I never had anyone ask for it by the glass. Mm-hmm. So I think you're onto something. Because that's apparently the hottest thing now.
They will all be available by the glass.
Bravo. Yep. Congratulations, man. Look, cheers. This is a nice little show tonight. And Andy, is your first time on with us.
Yeah.
Cheers.
You know, tell us about the one cider you made that really blew our minds was the apples you gathered on an island off of Maine. Would you tell us about that one? He needs a cider.
I think legally I shouldn't. but same idea with what we do in Hudson Valley. Just go around collecting apples off. This is a particular location because it's in. It's defined by an island. It's the same idea.
But you
idea.
Would say if you had apples from near the sea, would they perhaps have a salty character?
I don't think they did. I don't think they had a particularly salty character. No, I think I don't blame the. I think the flavor has more to do with the soil.
Really, that's
the
what
difference.
You think, the soil.
Yeah.
What, have you guys ever talked about that before, like soil and
yes,
terroir with apples?
Yeah. In fact, Andy's organizing a group of cider makers to specifically talk about stuff like that.
And what is that going to become?
Well, we don't know. It's a conversation that is begging to be had, especially in cider makers at our scale. I'm not alone on this. This isn't my idea. It's just it's something that. Well, let's go back a bit. I think I can't say enough. Steve Wood and Terry Maloney, these are huge influences, but I would consider them to be sort of first-generational cider revivalists, and I count myself among the second generation. And I personally think that people more our age, people just starting out now have more interest in the way the apples are growing. It's not just sort of accepting 20th century cultivation standards, certainly not the varieties handed down in the 20th century. So how apples are grown, it's a big topic in the wine world. It's naturally going to become a big topic in the cider industry. It sort of doesn't exist right now. Sadly, it doesn't exist, but it will.
All right, man. We're going to have to wrap it up. Does anyone want to follow up with anything about terroir, or do you want us to call it a night and pick good cider?
That's a whole other show.
Yeah, this is a good intro. We're going to do another show about cider, terroir, and Andy.
I would say one thing about terroir is that, you know, with wine grapes, it's clear to see it because you have Chardonnay planted all over the world. But with apples, it's such a wide blend, it's not as spot clear. But I think if you pay attention to regions, like especially the Pacific Northwest compared to the Northeast, that's going to be a very clear distinction at first. And so that, I think, will be, you know, one gross indication of terroir. Because the climate in the Northeast, we have more acidic apples. And so the acid structure and the sugar structure is going to be different.
Well, I want to thank everyone for joining me here at Edible in Manhattan's Good Cider event. There's some great people, Sarah Grady, Steve Sellen, Ben from Wassail, Andy Brennan, and Gay Howard from United States of Cider. Thanks so much for joining me and making this a special extra cider sessions on Beer Sessions Radio. And thanks, everybody. Thanks to our engineer, Jack Inslee, who's going to have to clean this up and take good care of it, and our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors. So, hey, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.